cheese, glorious cheese.
Tastes mighty inviting.
Cheese, glorious cheese.
Whether you like it,
this is KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Enjoy cheese, marvelous cheese, wonderful cheese, glorious cheese.
I love cheese. Whenever there's a conversation about dieting, I always interject, cheese is my downfall. I like all types of cheese, from supermarket to upmarket, from cooking cheese to smelly cheese. I like it all. I've never tried to make cheese at home. If I did, I would want to make one of the world's most delicious cheeses that I got at London's Borough Market when I lived in England. Bannon is a French cheese from Provence. It's an unpasteurized goat's milk cheese. It is a pungent, uncooked, unpressed cheese that has a fine, soft white pâté that is wrapped in chestnut leaves and tied with raffia. It doesn't melt in your mouth because it's a thick liquid the moment you cut into it. It was only available in late August and early September, so if I knew how to make it at home, I would have access to it every day. So this month, I'm off to learn about cheese making. The best place to start is at the beginning. So I started with a teacher.
My name is David Everett, and I'm the director of the Dairy Innovation Institute at Cal Poly. Cheese is concentrated milk, basically. One of the problems with milk is that it's easily perishable. So we need to transform it into something that's going to have a longer shelf life. Milk typically would spoil after about 2 weeks, but cheese you can have on the shelf for years as long as it's refrigerated. So cheese is effectively concentrated milk. We add a little bit of salt to it as a preservative. We add some culture to it, and it also helps in the preservation of the product.
So if I have my milk in the refrigerator for a month, because I don't drink a lot of milk, and it will have separated to a semi-clear liquid and then this gelatinous white stuff, is that cheese?
What you've just described there is basically acidified milk. And when that happens, all of the proteins clot and coagulate and slowly sink to the bottom. And what you see up the top is a clear liquid, and that's called whey.
So the little nursery rhyme with curds and whey is basically a nursery rhyme about making cheese.
That's right. Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, eating her curds and whey.
Little Miss Muffet sat on a tuffet, eating her curds and whey. Along came a spider who sat down beside her and frightened Miss Muffet away.
Professor Everett assured me that I should not strain, mold, and age the acidified milk in my fridge in an attempt to make cheese. But we did discuss how we got the cheese we eat today.
So we can go back about 8,000 years and find mention of the manufacturing, very basic manufacturing steps for cheese. It probably was first discovered by accident in places like Iraq or Iran or the Arabian Peninsula. The mammals back then that were milked would have been probably sheep and goats rather than the cows that we know now. So when they milked it, they would have perhaps stored it in the stomach of a kid or the lamb. And probably would have ridden off in the desert. And the combination of that stomach, with just simply a container, the heat of the desert, and the agitation of riding around would have transformed the milk into curds and whey. And that's very nutritious and tasty.
So how did we get to the cheese that we have today?
A lot of it is due to the different microbial population that grows in and on the cheese. And some of those microbes, nowadays we know what they are. Science has told us what they are. We can buy those specific cultures from a culture house. But back then, it would have been purely by accident. So they may have stored the cheese in a vault, cave, something like that, and there would have been a natural microflora population that grows in that cave, and it would have got onto the cheese and started growing and produced a different flavor profile. One example of that is Roquefort, which is a French blue cheese. It is made in a very specific region in France, the south central part of France. It's ripened in limestone caves. And the mold that grows in those caves gets into the cheese and starts growing and produces that unique flavor of Roquefort cheese.
Let's find out how this is done. I went up to Paso Robles, where one of the three creameries on the Central Coast is based.
Reggie Jones, I and my wife Kelly are the owners of Central Coast Creamery. This is my 27th year making cheese.
So this is where you make your cheese.
You see right here, we have a 1,500-gallon milk tank. So we bring in 1,500 gallons of milk at a time. And that allows us to make three batches of 500 gallons. So this is your vat pasteurizer. So we bring the milk up to 145 degrees, hold it for 30 minutes, take it back down, add the culture, add the enzymes. We do it through cooking steps before the milk turns into cheese. And then you have curds and whey. The curds and whey are pumped from that tank to this draining. And that's where we separate the curds and whey, put it in the forms, press it for a certain amount of time, and then put it into the brine for 48 hours. The brine, it's where the cheese takes up salt. When it takes up salt, it's actually expelling moisture into the brine, and it forms like a rind around the cheese to make it firm on the outside so that when we place it on the aging shelves, it doesn't flatten out. It maintains that nice shape. This is another aging room. This one is for our Alpine cheeses. Alpine meaning from the mountain regions, in the same class of like a Comté, Gruyère. Everything in here is about 7 months old before it comes out of this room and is ready for sale. All the cheeses in our ripening rooms have to be flipped over three times a week. So we currently have about 4,000 wheels that need to be flipped Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. All the boards have to be flipped over as well. The wooden boards, they pull the moisture away from the cheese surface, and that minimizes the amount of mold growth on the surface of the cheese during the ripening period.
Mold. Reggie said that the boards helped prevent mold from growing on the cheese. I thought that's what cheese was. So back to Professor Everett.
What makes this mold different than the green stuff that grows on our stuff that we leave in the fridge?
I often refer to that mold as bathroom mold. It's not nice. Now, molds can produce toxins, which are dangerous. Not all molds do that. A lot of molds are perfectly safe to eat. But some produce nice flavors, some produce terrible flavors. So really, it's a hit or miss. You just got to try it by trial and error. And if it tastes good and it doesn't kill you, then it's a great cheese. If it does kill you and it doesn't taste good, then it's a terrible cheese.
So Reggie wants the mold that's inside his cheese, not the mold that's outside his cheese. When they were inside his Swiss-style Alpine cheese, they form holes for his holy cow.
It usually takes us about 2 years from when we start to make a cheese to actually releasing it out for sale, because there's certain things that we're looking for in that cheese. We're looking for cheeses that fill a niche that's not being filled. The one good example is holy cow, because there was no Swiss made in California, and Swiss is the most difficult cheese to make. Everything has to be exactly right to get those hole formations. We call them eyes, or these ones here are pretty flat. This is one that's ready for sale, and how they're really round and puffy, that's the eye formation, the holes being formed in the cheese. And you can tell if you're getting the right eye formation really by tapping on the cheese in here, and it like just like a watermelon.
So the cheese actually grows while it's aging?
It does. These cheeses here are about 4.5 to 5 inches tall. When they start out, they're about 3.5 inches tall. A brand new one here.
Okay.
That's the proper holes. So you can hear the sound.
Very different sounds. Wow.
The two thumps did actually sound completely different.
Okay.
That's the proper holes.
Stop into the creamery if you didn't quite pick that up. Professor Everett mentioned that we now know what the molds are and we can buy them. The third creamery on the Central Coast described that process.
My name is Michelle Angel, and I am the co-owner of Stepladder Creamery. We get the molds from Glendairy Cheese Company in Canada. Margaret is a really great resource for us. We buy her culture. We don't cultivate it because it kind of helps keep consistency and flavors.
And apparently these molds aren't always the easiest to work with.
The only class of cheese that we really don't do is soft ripen, like a bloomy rind, like the white molded cheeses. You just need another separate space for that, because that'll get all over everything that you make. It's a really aggressive mold that'll just grow everywhere.
But those are the kinds of cheeses I like the best. Maybe I won't make cheese at home. The actual motivation for this playing with food was to find out why there are so few Central Coast cheesemakers, and not so much to learn how to make my own cheese. Stepladder Creamery in Cambria, Central Coast Creamery in Paso Robles, and Cal Poly Creamery are it. Here's what Michelle had to say, followed by Reggie and then Michael at Say Cheese Cafe, Bakery, and Cheese Shop in Santa Barbara.
Creameries are a bit hard to maintain. That's why I think there's so few of them. The government does have a lot of rules that make it hard. And also, if you're farmstead like us, milking animals twice a day every day is pretty labor intensive. In this county, a lot smaller production than Marin and the Mendocino counties. We don't mind competition at all. We'd actually would love to see more creameries out here. It would be a fun place to start the Central Coast Cheese Trail.
The cow milk comes from the last dairy in Santa Barbara County. It's called Cuyama Dairy. And then the goat milk and sheep milk come from the Lemoore area. So there's really no milk available in San Luis Obispo County. The reason there's no creameries here is because there's no dairies here. I think in the 1960s, there was about 400 dairy farms in this county. And now there's zero. There's the farmstead at Stepladder, and we've got a dairy at the Cal Poly Creamery, and that's it. We're just kind of waiting for another person to come on board and start bringing us local milk. The farmland is competing with wine grapes, and the return on a dairy is much less than on a wine grape. The water situation, we had a good year last year, but it's still the same. We're a deficit here where we're using more water than we're getting. Long term, it is very concerning. Creameries are high water usage places as well. You know, we have to clean all of our equipment every single day. And so we need water to do that, and good quality water.
I get asked that question all the time of people wanting to come visit and like, oh, let's go visit the cheesemakers. And I'm kind of like, well, there aren't any. One of the things that is really fascinating about cheesemaking and agriculture in general is the notion of terroir and making products and items that are naturally fit the area. And something that you kind of don't realize is that 100 years ago, the environment around here was all scrubland, very dry, very little water. Cows and cheesemaking require obviously lots and lots of water. The animals require very high quality feed, high quality grasses, and essentially you need water to do that. And that's why most of the cheesemaking in California is centered around the San Francisco area, Marin County. It's just a lot cooler climate, a lot more rain, a lot higher quality vegetation, which is more suited for cheesemaking than the dry land around here.
That explains why there are only three creameries on the Central Coast. According to Reggie, a new cheesemaker began operations about 2 months ago. It's also in San Luis Obispo County, in even the drier town of Santa Margarita. Fortunately, high-quality milk is not in short supply here in California, and our Central Coast cheesemakers can make a variety of types of cheese for us.
We make all sorts of different cheeses, primarily goat and cow blends, and mixed milk cheeses, hard cheese, and soft cheese. We milk our goats twice a day and yield about 20 to 30 gallons of milk a day. We make anywhere from 180 to 200 pounds of cheese 3 to 4 times a week.
Can you make cheese out of any mammal's milk?
I believe you can. Not that I've tried making cheese out of every mammal's milk, but you can certainly make it out of, and I'll give you the order of dominance. The first is cow's milk, which is about 84% of the world's cheese. The next is buffalo, curiously enough. That is the traditional way of making mozzarella cheese in Italy. Now, I don't know for certain, but it could be made into paneer, which is a very common cheese in India. The other ones are sheep and goat, so those are the four most common mammals. Camel's milk, I think it's rather difficult to do that. It can be made into yogurt, but it's not as easy to make it into cheese. So that's probably the fifth most common mammal for milking in the world. Deer milk, yes, you can. I've seen deer milk cheese. It was done as a research project. I haven't seen it commercially available. Pig milk cheese, I think that would have rather substantial marketing challenges associated with it, selling that in the supermarket. Whales and seals don't lend themselves particularly well to commercial dairying, have to say.
Pods of whales were being sighted off the Central Coast during the production of this show, but Professor Everett is right. It would be quite difficult to obtain their milk. I'm fine with Stepladder's goats. There's one more technical aspect of cheese that I've always wondered. What is American processed cheese food?
This was invented about 100 years ago. In fact, it was 100 years ago this year, in 1917. It was invented by the Kraft Food Company, and that was the processed cheese. It was made as a shelf-stable cheese that didn't require temperature control as much as the natural cheeses, so it wouldn't deteriorate as rapidly. And the purpose, I think, for developing this was to give it to soldiers who were fighting in World War I in Europe, so they could carry these cheeses around in cans and just use that as a meal.
There's no single cheese like Velveeta, 'cause Velveeta is more than one single cheese.
The way they make that is they take natural cheeses, such as Edam or Gouda, and they blend it up at a very high temperature, And we're talking about 175 degrees here. And they add a little bit of butter fat. They can add water. They can add milk powder if they want. And they can add emulsifying salts. And what that helps is to smooth out the texture of it.
Like Colby, Swiss, and cheddar.
Blend it all together for a creamy taste that melts with ease.
So by heating it up with all those ingredients, it makes a sort of a molten lava-like cheese product. And when you refrigerate that, it becomes a solid processed cheese, and it's very shelf-stable.
Velveeta processed cheese spread is so much fun. Lots of natural cheeses are better than one.
It doesn't contain any petroleum products, as which people assert that things like Velveeta and Kraft Singles are made from petroleum products.
I know, there's no petroleum products in there. The reason they people thought that is that those cheeses are referred to as plastic cheeses. By plastic, I don't mean fake, but by plastic, that is a textural term. So that means that when you press it, it deforms, and that's called plastic flow. So these are plastic cheeses because of the texture, not because of the flavor or any kind of hypothetical putative petroleum products.
Velveeta really knows how to please.
There's my answer. And to let my European friends know that American processed cheese food is not the only cheese, I put the question to the cheesemonger, Michael, at Say Cheese.
Why do we love Italian and French cheeses more than American cheeses?
You know, it's kind of a loaded question. I wouldn't say that that's necessarily accurate. You know, there are some really, really great cheeses being made here. The artisan cheese movement in the U.S. is more recent. The cheeses aren't as well known. In like the 80s and 90s is when it first got off the ground of people making cheeses on their own on the small scale with the pursuit of quality. It's been growing very strongly ever since, and there are some really, really amazing cheeses being made here in the States that I would put up against anything that we would get in from Europe.
I have decided against making cheese at home and went for the much easier method of playing with food, starting with Michael. He assured me that American artisan cheese is just as good as European cheese.
So can you help me pick out some California cheeses? Do you have many?
Yeah, we have several. Starting over here, we have the Mezzo Secco. This is an aged Jack cheese from Sonoma County. Jack cheese is one of the few American original cheeses. You know, a lot of cheeses we make are based on European styles, like, oh, here's a California Camembert or a Wisconsin Parmesan. Jack is a unique cheese that's uniquely American. Well, actually, when you buy it from the grocery store, it's fairly fresh and soft, but once you age it, it can get nuttier flavors, a sharper finish.
Is it true that Monterey Jack, its history was from the settlement of the Monterey area and they just needed a fresh, quick cheese?
Yeah, there was a guy, name was David Jack, who was an early settler to the area and started making cheese and called it Jack Cheese because that was his name. Moving into the soft cheeses, we have several from the Cowgirl Creamery. They started in the late 90s. The most famous is the Red Hawk. It is a triple cream, which means before they form it in the cheese, they actually add fresh cream to the mix, which makes it much more buttery.
And what's the pianoforte? Because that looks interesting because crock. I like things in little crocks.
So that is also made up near Petaluma by Andante Dairy. The pianoforte is based on a French cheese called Saint Marcellin, which is a soft, creamy brie style that's super, super delicious.
Great. Well, I think I want to try the pianoforte because it's in a little crock and I always go for that.
Yeah.
And some Monterey Jack.
Okay.
Great.
Let's do it.
Thanks.
The one in the little crock? The moment I broke through the rind, liquid cheese oozed out and across the plate, and not like American processed cheese food. I used a spoon to eat it because I didn't have bread to sop it up. It was indescribably delicious, and it whetted my appetite for more cheese, so I went to Fromagerie Sophie in San Luis Obispo to quench my thirst for more cheese.
Hi, I'm Paul Doring, and I am co-owner of Fromagerie Sophie with my wife, Sophie.
You do cheese, and you have wonderful cheese and wonderful cheese platters. And I'm looking at cheeses from the Central Coast, but as you know, there aren't very many. Why is that?
I think it's because we don't have as many green hills as they have in countries or places or regions that have more cheese.
I brought you some stuff out of my refrigerator. I have this wine from Harmony Cellars, and I also have a wine from Edna Valley Vineyards. So one's a white, and it was a kind of a mistake. It's a Muscat Canelli, but it's not supposed to be sweet. And then I have the winemaker series Malbec from Edna Valley, which I love their Malbec. And then I brought this something, because we think about meat and cheese together. I found this California salami called from Zoe's Meats, and it's cacao chili uncured salami. So do you think you could find me a cheese that goes with each of these?
Absolutely. This is like the moment of discovery. First, you have to figure out what the wine tastes like.
Okay.
And so you take a sip, and we'll do like two or three sips, because what you really want to know is, what's this taste like without anything else in the picture? So what Sophie has done for us is she's looked through the Book of Experts.
Okay.
And she has picked five cheeses for us to try and pair with this. And the first one is this one, a goat's milk cheese called Leonora, and this is from Spain. And like I said, she has not put a lot of local cheese on here because you saw in the case there were only two at the time. We usually will have several cheeses from California, a cheese or two from Wisconsin, some from Vermont, and several from Indiana. And why Indiana? Indiana is sort of like, it's like the center lane of Tornado Alley. And it's green. It's probably green all year long. So now our palates are familiar with the wine. And what we're going to do then is we're going to take a little piece of this cheese. We do wine, cheese, wine. And so what you're doing with the wine is you are, now that you're familiar with this, you just want to sort of like wet your palate and put it back in there. Yeah, that's right. That's fabulous. I love that. And in goes the cheese. And we're going to leave the cheese in our mouth for about 5 seconds or so. We're going to move it around. With the soft cheese, I like to tell people to just put it on the center of their tongue and paint your mouth with your tongue, because it's soft.
Wow, it really got the taste buds moving. Mm-hmm. I felt that tang in the back of my mouth, in a good way.
And you notice this cheese, it's all over.
Mm.
It's on your teeth, it's on your cheeks, it's on everything. And why we do that is because it does a couple of things. First of all, but first we have to go back to doing the second swish of the wine, because okay. Now we're going to taste some chemistry, I hope.
I didn't get any fireworks.
No, not fireworks, but it was basically pleasant.
Yeah.
So it's not a loser, but we can find plenty of things that combine nicely.
Okay.
I thought at first, though, that it brought the honey notes or the oak notes. Just piqued them just a tiny little bit. But again, that, just like you said, that's not what we call fireworks. Fireworks is fireworks. Chemistry. So let's try the second cheese then, which was the Villeved Gouda, which is this nice orangey Gouda. You notice this has little crystals inside of it. Everybody loves the crystals in Gouda. That is a good pairing.
What I'm finding amazing is that we're having cheese and red wine, and that's not port. Because, you know, those strong flavors, particularly blue cheese, mm-hmm. get countered by the sweetness of port. Mm-hmm. And here, there's no sweetness. This right. is a Malbec. This mm-hmm. is dry. This is tannins, mm-hmm. mellowed tannins. Mm-hmm. And there's zero fruit on this one. This is why right. I like it. Mm-hmm. But we're finding cheeses that maybe they
delicious
don't...
with them.
It's not fireworks necessarily, but it's delicious. It's delightful.
Yes. I thought that one was pretty close to firework.
I did it again. Mm-hmm. The piece without the rind, uh-huh. and it ever so slightly brought out some plum, a tiny bit of fruit.
Alpine cheeses and red wines almost always accentuate the fruit notes of the wine.
Despite the construction going on in the building next door and in the street in front, this was definitely playing with food. Paul and I spent about 2 hours tasting about 15 cheeses with the two wines and the salami I had bought.
Meat and cheese go together, but I have this really bizarre meat, this uncured salami with cacao and chili. Could you possibly have a cheese that goes with this?
Well, we'll give it a try. But you know what? We still have about 12 cheeses on the plate. I think we should just put
dig
a piece in our mouth and see what it tries to tell us.
So does that suggest you're treating the meat like the wine?
Yeah.
You put it in your mouth first?
Mm-hmm. Taste. But we do want to know what it tastes like. It's got a little kick. A little bit of pepper.
I think this doing the salami after didn't pick up the blue, but doing the blue after the salami picked up the salami.
One of the things that I wish people would do more with their food is they would let food take its turn, the different flavors take their turns owning their palate. And then the change in flavor from one flavor to another, from the saucisson to the blue cheese, it's pleasurable when your mouth is changing flavors. And then the blue cheese owns your mouth for a while. You run everything back again, then you switch over to the meat again. And when the transition doesn't produce a nasty flavor, like acridity or just yuck, it's like, oh, well, now we know what to put on our little hors d'oeuvre plate, because it's fun. It's fun to go back and forth between different flavors.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh. It's Sophie herself.
Oh my gosh.
Are you guys
Hello.
Having fun?
There were a couple surprises along the way. Brilliant. Well, can I say, to my ultimate surprise, I thought the best pairing was the truffle with the Malbec.
That is the ultimate surprise.
And I don't like truffles.
Wow.
Do you think that was a good pairing?
I thought it was fabulous.
And Paul taught me some tricks of the trade. When you only have a wine label, mm-hmm. how do you start to decide what goes with what?
Fortunately for us in getting our start in this, we found lots of good cheese book authors. People who write very well, they're easy to understand, and they really know a lot about what we're getting started doing. Basically, they will give you the roundabout idea that this kind of wine goes with approximately this kind of cheese or these couples of different types of cheese. And so when we go to do a pairing like this, we will start with what they've suggested and then try to narrow it down from there just with our taste buds.
Is it becoming more challenging, particularly with wine, because wine isn't consistent anymore? You used to know what a California Chardonnay is. You can't really know that if you buy a Chardonnay. Same with all of the other varietals that we're used to. Does that make it more challenging and like you're always on your toes?
Yeah, it's absolutely more challenging, and that's why we have the wineries who we do business with. They come in when they're about to release a wine, and we make sure that either what it was paired with before is going to work for the new vintage, or we find the new cheese that's going to work with the new vintage. It changes by vintage, and so last year's cheese may not go so well with this year's wine.
This was by far the tastiest playing with food that I have done. Okay, so I didn't actually produce anything in my kitchen. I'll let Professor Evert, Reggie, and Michelle do that for me, and I'll spend more time with Paul, Sophie, and Michael to help me play with the different cheeses and meats and wines. I'll leave the hard work to the experts.
It's hard work. It's a labor of love. I mean, we love creating something out of milk. You know, we take great quality milk from producers that we trust, that we know are doing a great job supplying that great quality milk so that we can convert that into great quality cheese. We've actually won more national, international awards in the last 5 years than any cheesemaker in the Western United States. Just some of the best cheese in the world is actually being made right here in Paso Robles.
That says it all.
Cheese, glorious cheese.
So sumptuous and luscious.
Cheese, marvelous cheese.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. I'm Father Ian, and I'm playing with food.
Sing with real cheese.